you know, the richness is when we're not just spying for hope, like trying to find it in the literature that we read, but it's also in what way can I be a double agent and sneak this hope and joy into the work that I write.
Welcome to the Habit Podcast, conversations with writers about writing. I'm Jonathan Rogers, your host. Sarah Arthur has written and published a dozen books over the last 20 years or so, but her new book, Once a Queen, is her first foray into fiction. Once a Queen is a portal fantasy with clear connections to the books of E. Nesbitt, The Secret Garden, and The Chronicles of Narnia. In this conversation, Sarah and I talk about literary influences, both conscious and unconscious, writers' groups, and being a spy for hope. Sarah Arthur, I'm so glad to have you on the Habit Podcast to talk about Once a Queen, your new novel.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you.
So what's the short version of what Once a Queen is about? Give me a quick overview that you tell people when they ask.
A quick overview. I have a 14-year-old protagonist named Eva, who has never before met her British grandmother. So she spends the summer in England at her grandmother's estate and begins to realize that things are not well with grandmother. Things are strange and weird. And not only that, but she begins to suspect that the fairy tales that she grew up hearing as a child that she loved and thinks she maybe doesn't believe anymore might be one of the reasons why her grandmother is not well. And now there's a mystery she's got to figure out and solve.
Okay.
Several mysteries, like why the estrangement in the family? What's up with grandmother's weird behavior?
Yeah. Why is there a secret garden?
Secret gardens. You have to have secret gardens. I mean, you have to have a manor house in England, you know, all that.
Absolutely. Yeah. You have been working on this book for a long time, something like 20 years, right?
I have. So I've been publishing in the nonfiction space for a long time. My first book was Walking with Frodo, A Devotional Journey Through the Lord of the Rings, which came out when the films were in theaters. And I had just been in full-time youth ministry and was absolutely burned out and, you know, needed to get back to that writing in that creative space. But all my youth ministry instincts were like, these are great stories. I know all kinds of stuff about Tolkien and his faith. Let's get talking about that and write the kind of resources I wish I had had as a youth worker. And so that was the first book that came out. And of course, you know, that one did well. It was very timely. And I was supposed to be writing other books when I got the idea for this one. Deadlines, man, like one contract after another talking and really in a space I love, which is that intersection of faith and great literature and all the rich conversations you can have there. Right. So books about, I did one about The Hobbit and The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe and Pride and Prejudice, anthologies for Paraclete Press, collections of poetry and fiction by Christians throughout the centuries, a spiritual biography of Madeleine L'Engle, who wrote A Wrinkle in Time. That has been my space, but behind the scenes, my first love fiction, I've been chipping away at this Once a Queen for a longer than I've known either of my middle school age sons.
I read somewhere that you started thinking about this story when you learned about a railway disaster.
I did.
Tell me about that.
Yeah. So I think, and this is where, you know, my brain, when I'm trying to work on nonfiction, is all over the place. And I, you can see a lot of the influences in my fiction of people like C.S. Lewis, Tolkien, E. Nesbitt, you know, The Secret Garden. But it's also in the water as I'm writing nonfiction. And something I was working on at the time sparked this idea, like, what gave C.S. Lewis the idea that a rail crash in which many lives were lost, and of course I'm referring to The Last Battle. No spoilers. Hopefully people have read it by now.
They had their chance.
They've had lots of time. I was like, what would make that plausible to his readers? That's a big crap. Like, that's a lot of people. Why would that have even sounded plausible to his young readers in Britain? And so I just, for whatever reason, Googled British rail crashes, and up came the largest civilian rail crash in British history, which I'd never heard of. Once. October 8th, 1952. And it was, 112 people were killed because it was three trains at rush hour, one of them a high-speed train. Colossal tragedy, 340-ish people wounded. And now in the 20 years since I've discovered that online, there's now footage of it. You can go online and see some of the original sort of BBC footage of this huge tragedy. Uh-huh. And this is not super long after World War II. So immediately everybody, like the neighborhoods empty out, they're all there. People are helping try to get people out of train cars. And yeah. So it so struck me because the timeline of Lewis writing The Last Battle, he began it that fall.
Is that right?
52. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, well, there it is. Of course, his readers would find that entirely plausible.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I was like, well, what if there was a character, if I were to tell the story, what would I do with the survivors there? Mm-hmm. Like, we're leaving these people with this horrific tragedy. What if, right? So I began with a supposal, which is the way Lewis talks about Narnia.
When you think about a disaster like that, and there are, hundreds of injuries and deaths, and as you point out, every one of those is a story, right? I mean, that's not one story. That's, I think we're up to about 400 or 500 stories, plus the people who came, their story. I mean, there's all these stories.
First responders. And since then, I'm not the only one who's written about this. I mean, there've been other people and who have interviewed, some of the folks who were there. But yeah, I mean, even as I was looking into it, the 50th anniversary of the rail crash was 2002. And there was they had a prayer service at the local Anglican church, and people came out who lost family members in that crash. There's a placard there, that tells that this is where this real happened at the Harrow and Wealdstone Station in Northwest London. So, in my mind, it was like, in a fantasy, you can kind of gloss the trauma of that and just sort of move on. Like, oh, that's sad. And now we get to have fun in this beautiful heavenly country.
Yeah.
But the people left behind, I was really struck by that. You have to live your life. You have to go on. Mm. And the same is true after war. But now these people had two hits, right? They had World War II and now this. So that kind of was the seed of the idea.
Yeah. So you've already touched on some influences. I do want to talk about, you as a in this, in Once a Queen, it's your influences are, at least some of your influences are clear, right?
Yes.
You've already mentioned.
Yeah, they're absolutely overt because.
Okay.
I didn't need reviewers being like, it sounds just like blah, blah, blah. And I from the beginning, I was like, yes, it does. I'm evoking all that on purpose because there's a different kind of story I want to tell, but I need all of that to be part, that's part of it. It reminds me a little bit of, the Lewis himself was hugely influenced by The Snow Queen by Hans Christian Andersen.
Mm,
he
yeah.
was hugely influenced by E. Nesbitt, including, The Aunt and Amabel, which is this little short story about this little girl who goes through a magic wardrobe and becomes a queen in another world.
Huh.
1908, I think, or 1912. And he insisted he had never read that story, but like, who remembers everything they read as children, right?
I know.
So, when you don't acknowledge your sources, it's just awkward. And it, I felt in this day and age, you have to, right?
Yeah.
You don't get to just be the the white British dude who has permission to do whatever he wants with people's previous work.
Yeah.
But even Tolkien, you know, influenced by Wagner's Ring Cycle. It's like, it's, you know, nobody's an original genius.
Yeah.
Just and how overt will you be about those?
I'm sorry, what was it? What did you just say?
Yeah, or it's just how overt.
Overt. Yeah.
Both those influences. Right.
Well, I've always thought the question, who your influence is kind of a strange question, because the only way you can answer that question is to answer, here are the influences that I know of, know of, B, are willing to cop to. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the idea of the sort of aspirational influences. Like, I wish I could say I was influenced by, you know, John Milton, so I might say that. And I mean, there are some pretty there are some pretty lowbrow stuff that I would say influences my own fiction that I don't want to say out loud, or for that matter, problematic. Right? I mean, I don't want to get into problematic influences, because that's problematic. But
I mean, like in some ways we can sort of like define problematic, and that is exactly the conversation about kids' access to books right now. Mm-hmm. And I run in circles where it's like people who are incredible Christian people are having their books banned and censored. So Lewis would talk about, he was a product of, you know, these long hallways full of the books, and there was no limit on what he read. And look at what God did in his life, right? So I get a little, I think the question of who are your influences is interesting and also kind of odd, because we all have access to a lot of the same stuff. Uh-huh. And to the point where, this book, I was done, almost done with Once a Queen and The Light, and I met Laura Weymouth, who wrote The Light Between Worlds. Uh-huh. Notice the stag.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah,
there's the stag.
Two girls who are sisters, one of whom is very broken, trying to get back to a magical world where they were people, you know, they were somebody.
Yeah.
And it stags and paintings. And I read, you know, Laura had reached out to me about my Madeleine L'Engle book and was like, could be like besties. And then she told me, I don't know, I don't want to like be weird, but I feel like you would love my book, A Light Between Worlds. She sent it to me and I was like, this is frightening, because there are literally entire sections of it where I'm like, does she live inside my brain? Yeah. And what it is when you have marinated long enough in a lot of the same literature, the flavor of what you do is going to be really similar. The Inkwell Chronicles, another one, there's a train crash. You know, the kids are, it's a wonderful middle grade, playing around with Lewis and Sayers and Tolkien and all of that. And a train crash, right? Yeah. That same one. So it's eerie. The more access we have to a broader scope of things, the more we're going to meet people whose interior, imaginative, and theological landscape is similar.
Yeah.
We'd love to be original geniuses, but I don't.
Yeah.
I love my children and their creativity, but, you know, those come along every once in a while. But
yeah.
A century.
Yes. And the people we think of as original geniuses, it's just a little late in the process for anybody to be an original genius, right?
Yeah, correct. How many thousands of years are behind us now? And when you're as widely read as someone as C.S. Lewis, even back then, like incredibly well read, like imagine somebody asking him his influences. I think he would have like, next question.
Yeah. Well, and
where do you start?
Yeah. And think about, you know, the way, I love the way Tolkien talks about it, leaf mold of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. One aspect of leaf mold, an important aspect, is it doesn't look like leaves anymore. It just goes in there.
Yep.
And it gets decomposed into something that is rich and that is fertile.
Yeah.
But it's not leaves anymore. And you can't say, okay, well, this was a leaf from that from that oak tree over there, and this is a leaf from that elm tree over there. It's just leaf mold. And what are your influences? I don't know. I mean, I know I've got a few conscious influences for my own storytelling.
Yeah.
But there, I've only got, by definition, all you've got is conscious ones. I mean, the only ones you can talk about are the conscious ones.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, I'm labeling all the conscious ones. Although, you know, it was interesting when I did this biography of Madeline L'Engle, and went back and reread things like Walking on Water that had been hugely influential to me in my 20s, and realized, oh, so much of what I say about writing, imagination, the arts, all of it. Like, I didn't, like, entire phrases, like, I swear, lifted from that. I mean, Jeffrey Overstreet talks about how he can, like, quote from Walking on Water, like, it's passages of sacred scripture. Like, it's like, it just lodges in your brain.
Yeah, absolutely.
And sometimes the source is mysterious to us. Sometimes we can trace it, but yeah, compost.
Yeah, no, I've got a
compost.
Yeah. There's a joke in my novel, The Charlatan's Boy, that I was just so proud of. I thought I was so smart for coming up with this joke, and I ran across it recently in another book that I know I had read before.
Oh, that's frustrating. Catherine Patterson wrote Bridge to Terabithia, and she thought that word Terabithia was super, like she came up with that. And then she was reading The Voyage of the Dawn Treader and realized it's very similar to the name of one of the islands.
Really? I just assumed she
she was so appalled at that discovery.
Well, that explains why I didn't know why there was an N. It's Terabithia, I think, in Narnia, right? And it's Terabithia in her.
Or Terabithia something. Its spelling is slightly different.
That's interesting. I had no idea that she accidentally lifted that.
No, it's crazy to me. But speaking of her, I had had mentioned, interest in this quote that that I talked about from her. I want to be a spy for hope.
Yeah.
I heard her give that, she gave a talk at a couple different places, and that like, I'm much more interested in spying for hope than I am trying to figure out what my influences were.
Oh yeah.
because really the people that have most influenced me have been the ones to provide some kind of turn towards joy or hope in their work, instead of the sort of grim doom or apocalyptic meh that we read in a lot of you know, not just fantasy, but stuff.
Yeah.
And that was, to me, that's really the rich, you know, the richness is when we're not just spying for hope, like trying to find it in the literature that we read, but it's also, in what way can I be a double agent and sneak this hope and joy into the work that I write?
Tell me about that idea of being a double agent. What does that mean?
In my years in youth ministry, found that a lot of, when I first met my husband at Wheaton College, when we were in our, you know, he was in his late teens. I'm a little older than him, but anyway, I found that when you are talking directly about theological truths, biblical truths, there's this wall that goes up. It's a wall of resistance, and you know, it for me in youth ministry, one of the key things that I began to do was to go to just not go through the front door of the intellect and reason and that resistance, but to go through the back door of the imagination, which often people leave wide open, right? Or at least unlocked. Through stories and film, and that became the way in to, and sort of smuggling stuff in, not because I was trying to be sneaky, but because, kids were hungry for hope and hungry for like an actual true joy that was deeper than happiness. And I was like, well, if you won't let me deliver the pizza of this awesomeness to the front door, I'm going to bring it to the kitchen at the back door.
Yeah.
And here you go. Right. Like, here I am at the kitchen table. I've got the pizza of awesomeness and you're hungry. So let's have a meal. And so I would do things like leading small groups on the silver chair and, you know, engaging them in film. And of course, the first book I wrote was Walking with Frodo. So when C.S. Lewis talks about how we have to sneak past those watchful dragons, we have to strip the truth of its Sunday school stained glass, you know, connotations. Well, let's just tell stories then. Why not? What could be more fun?
Yeah. So Sarah, this of course is a portal fiction story, right? Your girl is, Eva is from this world, from Connecticut and, you know, and then England. And then she passes through a portal to another world. Tell me about before we started recording, we started on the subject a little bit of portal fiction and why you like the kind of fantasy that puts one through a portal to another world.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, it's a, I think some of it is temperament. When I was a kid, I loved, you know, Wrinkle in Time and stories that start in our world. Chronicles of Narnia is another one, obviously. And then a lot of E. Nesbitt's stories, the kids, you know, start off often they're visiting relatives, you know, on a summer break, or they're stuck at boarding school or whatever, as I begin the way I begin West of Queen. And yeah, and for me, even, you know, the Secret Garden, where there's these magical elements that kind of break through or break in, those are the things that really I find intriguing. And I didn't connect with straight fantasy like The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings till college, actually, when I was assigned to read that. I would get as far as Tom Bombadil and The Lord of the Rings and just be like, yeah, no, can't do the songs and the poetry today. And I think that also, like, you have to buy into the world. Like, you have to connect with it immediately when it's straight fantasy. And at least for me, there weren't a lot of stories where there was a character that I could connect with immediately. You know, at least in The Lord of the Rings, there's eventually Eowyn, but everyone else is either this, like, beautiful elf queen or horrific spider. Those are all the females in the story. So, you know, like, where can I connect? I don't know. Maybe Ursula Le Guin would have saved me. But again, it wasn't a genre I really liked. But the theologian in me, and I'm a graduate of Duke Divinity School, the richness of what portal fantasy can evoke, that at any moment, another world, another reality can break in on this one. You could literally be walking down the street and something could pop out of a stop sign. That's fun, right? Mm-hmm. Like, to me, there's so much you can do with that. Not just creatively and imaginatively, but theologically, because that is the world we live in.
Yeah.
That at any moment, another kingdom is breaking in on this one.
You know the story about Thomas Merton on the street corner in Louisville?
Yes, yes.
As the vision of people shining. The shimmering
transformation. Yeah, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
It does, you've pointed out something really interesting, is that it does have a kind of, it does stand in the stream of kind of the, not just contemplative Christianity, but the mystics, right? So like this, that they've encountered something that absolutely transformed the way they see the world, was re-enchanted. Which is the phrase Lewis uses.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't send you back to our world, like, despising it. You're enchanted by it. Like, now maybe trees can talk and walk. but in scripture, they clap their hands. So why not?
Yeah. I never put it together until you just said it. How often kids in these stories are visiting relatives when they go into another world. Is there something to say about that? Or is that,
I mean, even Harry Potter isn't home, you know, he's having to grow up in the home of a household that where he doesn't fit in. And then he goes off to boarding school. I think that liminal space of not being where you fit in is pretty important. It's pretty rich too. So of course my story begins she's in the car ride on the way to her grandmother's estate. And it was important to me that it's, she's not anywhere yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
No place that really is home for her. And even when she talks about life in Connecticut, with her father's scholarly pursuits, they've never really had a house. You know, it's always been just student housing or apartments. Yeah. And there is, and so in her mind, Carrick Hall has all this potential, you know, her grandmother's yeah. to finally be home. And yes, but also she's a stranger there. She doesn't yeah. fit. Yeah. Yeah. And that's adolescence in a nutshell.
Yeah, right.
You know, yeah. So
I have to say, when I saw that the father was an adjunct professor, I thought, oh no, this is it's not just a fantasy, it's a horror story.
Yes, he's getting paid in like t-shirts and bumper stickers, and no wonder they're poor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you make an excellent case for portal fantasy. Thank you for that. Because I sometimes have my doubts. I mean, I have mixed mm-hmm. feelings about, unlike you, it's like when I see the Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, I'm like, okay, now we're getting somewhere. We're not having to pass through a, you know, a wardrobe or a whatever or a picture of a ship to get there.
Right, right.
And,
yeah.
But well, I love that idea that it's a, of its connection to the mystic tradition. That's really good.
Hmm. Good. Yeah.
Okay. Feel free to write portal fantasy if you want
okay.
to.
Oh, well, thank you for that permission. no, but I do think it's in part a temperament thing, not just for genre, but like not yeah. everybody's enamored with the mystic tradition or even understand yeah, right. either. So thank God for multiple possible journeys that mm-hmm. to engage, you know, the spiritual life.
Yeah.
So.
So wait, is Harry Potter, is it portal fiction or is it a fantasy world?
It's another world layered on this one, and you only see it if you have the eyes to see it. Yeah. So if you're a muggle, you're not going to see it. But if you, you know, are part of the wizarding community now with this entire, like, now you're looking at Google Earth with the map of the roads on top of it.
Yeah,
all
right.
The things. You're seeing it all. So it's interesting. It's also kind of a school story, which mm-hmm. Lewis wasn't particularly fond of, you know, it's like the heroic kid that
yeah, right.
saves the day.
Yeah. Right.
And so, you know, there's strengths and weaknesses to that as well. Yeah.
Sure. Okay. I want to talk about the fact that you are in a romance writers group. that you hang out with romance writers. Tell me about that.
I did. Right. So I lived for a number of years in a small town in northern Michigan, where, you know, writing groups are few and far between. But I happened to meet this one gal who was the only published author I knew at the time. And she was a romance writer. And so she's like, yeah, well, there's this small group of us that get together once a month. And why don't you join us? Either that or she had a group that kind of fell apart and then she was pulling a new one together. I mean, this is ancient history by now. So so we would meet at Big Boy once a month.
Oh yeah.
In the back, like sort of conference room. It was just four of us. And uh-huh. them would bring their romance chapters. I could still tell you about these people in their books. And Jenna's would go on to get published. It was crazy to me how many books she was cranking out. And I would bring my little chapters from Once a Queen.
Yeah.
but what I loved about meeting was those gals is that they knew how to create characters that you cared about.
Hmm.
And they pointed out to me when I clearly didn't like a character of mine.
Oh, wow.
Because in their genre, you know, it wasn't like these weren't bodice rippers. I mean, the main published author was a Christian and, but they know their genre. You have to like your main character and yeah. their love interest. So that was really good. And they also yeah. had a very clear structure. I mean, the romance genre is has tropes and very clear structure and expectations. And I had none. And so it was really good for me to be like, yeah, what is the narrative arc? Like, what am I going for here?
Yeah.
Am I trying to write the great American novel, or, you know, am I actually going to, like, my readers are going to actually want to read it?
Yeah. I love the idea of the way a small town requires people. You know, if you live in a big city, you can say, okay, I am going to join the portal fiction, you know,
young adult.
Yeah. And in a small town, you may be thrown in, you know, you're just glad to have a group. And if they're all romance writers.
Well, great. And the internet wasn't, like, again, ancient history, like there were no, I wouldn't be, you know, Zoom wasn't a thing. How do you find people?
Yeah.
So I was eventually in another group that was all like the, they were all faculty at the local community college. Uh-huh. Many of them were adjunct faculty. And they were all like, they were very angsty. You know, this was literary work they were doing.
Yeah.
And that was also good for me because first of all, they were not necessarily people of faith. Yet I found myself in richer spiritual conversations with that crew and their poetry, or whatever they were doing. And that was lovely and made me realize that I don't write just straight literary fiction either.
Mm-hmm.
That was good.
Yeah.
You're still some of my great friends.
That's neat. You're not in this small town anymore?
No, I'm in Lansing, Michigan. My husband's a pastor, and this is where the bishop appointed him after seminary. So we're here. And I just actually started a writer's collective based on we have multiple campuses of our church, and this one's up on the northeast side, kind of East Lansing, Michigan State University on one side, and the city of Lansing on the other, called the Eastwood Writers Collective. And we meet every other Sunday from about 12:30 to 2:30. And it's we just gotten started, but people seem to be really into it.
So, what happens at this writers collective?
Well, we just start off kind of making sure everybody knows each other because we've just started. And then we break into groups of 3 to 4 to read our work. And everybody brings about 1 to 2 pages. And we have kind of a rubric for readers and a rubric for the listeners. And it's all, you know, meant to kind of push us to the next level in our writing. And some are that they've never done anything like this before. A couple of us are published authors. It's all kinds of genres. Somebody who's translating from Japanese, another person writes spoken word poetry, essays, memoir. So
yeah. Do you know who you're going to be in a group with when you get there?
Well, at this point I've been sort of facilitating, like I'll bounce from one of the smaller groups to the other. Like we just split off in the building and then do our thing.
I mean, if I join your collective, will I know who my partners are, or do I get there and then discover I'm hit with the Japanese translator?
Well, for last 2 Sundays ago was the first time we split off into our groups, and I just kind of put people in groups based on what I thought would be a good fit. Yeah. They loved it. And I thought we would just change it up every time, but they were like, we stay with the same people. And I was like, sure. but we also have built into our guidelines that we welcome newcomers, and that each time kind of stands alone. So there's a couple of people who their focus will be on whoever new shows up. So,
I'm just always interested in knowing how writers groups work.
Yeah. Yeah. I do too.
Yeah.
I think they're all different. And mine meets at our church, but it's not just church people. You know, I've lived here long enough, 15 years, to kind of have a pretty broad network. So
Right.
Be interesting. We'll see how it goes. They may all meet each other in a couple months. I don't know. We'll find out.
Yeah. You may have all, there may be feuds. Who knows what's going to come out of this?
Yeah. Yeah. We could end up with 4 of us. That all write young adult fiction. I don't know. We'll find out.
I know I'm bouncing all over the place. I'm sorry, but there's so many interesting things to talk about.
Oh, you're fine. Oh, yeah.
I'm interested in
Remember, I've been in youth ministry for 30 years. So like literally nothing you throw at me is going to
talking to me is like talking to a junior high person.
No, it's 100% easier. Trust me.
Yeah, okay, good. I do love the fact that at the beginning of each chapter, you have an excerpt from a novel that, or maybe it's
collection of stories. Novels.
Mm-hmm. The Turnival stories. I just love that you get this bonus, you get this bonus book within the book.
Yes.
And there's a sentence. It wasn't even their fault about the lettuces or anyway, I love that sentence, but that's not the point. The point is that the book that you are excerpting from, which you also wrote, I hope that's not a
No. I mean, people have had to Google it though. Various reviewers were like, for a second there, I thought Clifton was a real person, and I was trying to find him online and these books, but then I realized no, it's an invented.
It's kind of a
collected tales.
Mm-hmm. Kind of a Princess Bride kind of thing.
Yep.
But you say something. So she's talking about the books, and she says you got a first person narrator. The collection was incomplete. As if Clifton intended to write a sequel, but never got around to it. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, one suspects that maybe this book, the life she's going to live here in this book, will prove to be the sequel that wasn't written yet. And
Ooh, that's fun. Yeah. Yeah. We'll see how it all unfolds. It does indicate that there's more. Definitely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if that wasn't a question, I realized, but I wonder if especially when you think about your own, as you said, your overt commitment to your influences. Mm-hmm. In some ways, every story we write is a sequel to something that, it's a sequel that didn't get that in this case, that Lewis and Nesbitt and Tolkien didn't get around to. And here you're writing the sequel that they didn't get around to.
Oh, that's fun. I mean, so I'm a huge fan of Dorothy Sayers, and she's in the middle of writing another Lord Peter Wimsey novel when she died. Mm. And I forget the woman's name who completed it. Like, it's called Thrones Dominations, I think. And I was so familiar with Sayers that when I started the book, I was like, oh, this is straight up Sayers. And then I knew almost immediately when it was no longer Dorothy Sayers. And so I think it's not unusual to have somebody's work unfinished. Mm-hmm. And at least in the case of Clifton, there's way more going on there that's all tied up with Eva's family history, but you don't know that at first. And so that's part of why you want to keep reading and like, well, then where is the rest of the material? What happened to that? And that's also part of the mystery, and definitely sets up the sequels to Once a Queen. We have two more books coming, Once a Castle and Once a Crown. So, I started to like have to leave those Easter eggs in there.
That's right.
Eventually, and then realized I have not just Easter eggs. These are loaded guns, and these suckers are going to start going off. And I got to figure out how to do this in a way that doesn't create just complete chaos.
Yeah. Like book two.
So, yeah. And that's where I'm at right now.
Yeah. Book two. You're in the middle of book two.
I am. Yes.
Overdue from what I hear.
Oh, thank you. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. It is. That's. Yeah. So the first book took me 20 years to write, as we've discussed. And I now have to write this one in a number of months. So I feel pretty good about the fact that I did indeed start it less than a year ago, and I already more than halfway.
Still.
Kudos to those people that just can crank stuff out, because that's not me.
Yeah. All right, we're going to wrap this up here so that you can go continue.
Oh, thank you.
Too, and not make everybody wait any longer than you've already done.
Right. Or myself.
But I do need to know, I do need to hear, this is the question I typically ask. And in some ways, you've been answering this question all along, but you may have additional questions. You have additional answers. And that the question is, who are the writers that make you want to write?
Oh, yeah. Well, and that answer has changed, you know, at different seasons in my life. But right now, I have become really enchanted with writers who are connected with We Need Diverse Books. Sayantani Dasgupta, whose name I'm probably not pronouncing correctly, the Karen Mala series. She's writing fantasy from the standpoint of an Indian immigrant family. Oh. And it's marvelous. And I love how she's doing what I see European, you know, writers of European descent doing, is taking the mythologies and the stories from her home country, and like, it's portal fantasy, you know. Love that. I'm also been really interested in the writings of Daniel Neri.
I was wondering if he was going to come up, because
marvelous. Again, I mean, he
does such great things with those stories of.
Oh gosh! Oh, absolutely. I mean, he's written A Thousand and One Nights is what he's written.
Yeah.
And Everything Sad is Untrue. And then his book, The Many Assassinations of Samir, the Seller of Dreams, just won a Newbery Honor.
Yeah.
And these are phenomenal writers it's not just the amplification of those voices that I love. It's the richness of what they're doing and how that like just energizes me.
You can talk about it in terms of amplifying their voices, and you can also talk about it in terms of, I didn't know these Persian stories, and now I do. And my world has just expanded in huge ways from reading, you know, Daniel Neri's
stories. Absolutely. Well, and Sayantani Dasgupta is, she's writing out of, you know, her tradition, which is not in any way similar to mine. But she's pulling similar, you know, virtues and qualities out that that remind me too, like how universal so much of this is, in the sense that we are like there's a journey that we're on, and there's a recognition that what we see in front of us is not the only only things that we see, and just a deep, profound respect for the capacity of young people to care. About their families, about, you know, spiritual questions.
Yeah.
That's powerful. That's beautiful. And it gives me hope.
Yeah. Well, Sarah Arthur, thank you for being a spy for hope.
I stand on the shoulders of giants with all that.
Yeah.
As do we all.
You sneak around under the cloak of giants. I'm not sure what the right metaphor is for spies, but yeah. But thanks for being here. What a great talk.
Just lovely. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
This podcast is brought to you by The Rabbit Room, where art nourishes community and community nourishes art. And all our podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our members. To learn more about us, visit rabbitroom.com. And to become a member, rabbitroom.com/donate.